The Bible is not shy about sex and sexuality, should we be? Hello, welcome to Good Word. I am David Thomas, your host for this quarter. We are in the middle of a series of lessons that run for 13 weeks, talking about various rhythms in life, focused primarily on family and how family relates to community and so forth. And today, the lesson actually is drawn from the book, The Song of Solomon, a book that a lot of people don't like to talk about, a lot of people allegorize. I'm here with two conversation partners, Brant Berglund and Jen Ogden, and thank you for joining me today. Mm-hmm. I trust you're not afraid to take up the subject. And let me ask, first of all, how do you approach the book, The Song of Solomon? How do you see it as allegorical? Some people see it merely as a description of wisdom, you know, some see it as romance. So let me hear from you. How do you approach the book?
Well, it is certainly in the general collection in the Old Testament of wisdom literature, along with Job.
And what do you mean by wisdom literature?
Wisdom literature, Proverbs, Job, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon is a collection that entails what we might call the natural law and order of life, that God has orchestrated a natural world that functions according to set rules, and within those set rules, we can expect generally consistent results if we behave in certain ways.
And so by studying that, we can obtain some wisdom. That's why it's called wisdom literature?
Yeah, certainly, both about how the world works and about how God works in the world. Song of Solomon, though, is a love song. And on its surface, it is a love song between a woman and a man who are enjoying each other's company. There are, I believe, some very strong euphemisms for sexual activity, if I can put it that way, and what a couple in love would enjoy in the bedroom. And I think that is it. You don't have to read with a dirty mind to see it. I think they come out fairly strongly.
Yeah. How do you approach it, Jen? Do you have anything to say about the Song of Solomon? Is it an allegory, or do you see it as real life story kind of a thing?
I think that if we were to allegorize it and keep it strictly in the category of allegory, we miss out on the depth of relationship and the intimacy and the wonder and vulnerability that can come. And I think that it has for too long been seen merely as an allegory. And I think it is kind of a real account of a falling in love. And I think those are important accounts because I don't think God put us here alone. And to build community, to build bonds is really important in the family of God and in a marital and family relationship. So I think that we need to see it as a real life story.
And if a husband and wife are not going to be able to read it that way, I'd say they have challenges in their relationship. Because Song of Solomon, I think, can say things to what a healthy love relationship can look like between two committed people, especially within a marriage context. Yeah.
Now, whenever the question of sex or sexuality comes up, it seems to me that one of the foundational principles that ought to be discussed is the fact that, contrary to pagan Platonic systems, in the Bible, the human body and its drives are not perceived to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
The,
true.
The body and its biological drives can be used for evil and so forth, but they are not inherently bad. And it seems to me then that if that's the case, then all the bodily functions have a certain element of nobility to them. The fact that you get hungry, the fact that you have to relieve yourself, the fact that you have to sleep, the fact that you like to have some kind of intellectual stimulation, the fact whatever the biological drive is, there is it's not an evil thing that is to be denied and suppressed, and the same would go for sex. So you agree with that?
I would agree with that tremendously. And one of the challenges we have in our day and age is when young people are reaching the age of sexual maturity, it's quite a bit younger than young people today are actually beginning to engage in a family life, right? And so we have this great gap between when young people are ready for sexual encounter and when marriage actually occurs. And so there's a huge challenge, but yet we shouldn't shy away from the topic. I am in some ways sensitive about the language we use with sexuality because I think in today's culture, we often make it dirty. And I think we need to hold sexuality and what the act is and what the beauty is of it in high esteem. And our language should reflect that. But we shouldn't be shy about talking about it. But when we talk about the human body was made by God. He put man and woman in the garden and he says, be fruitful and multiply. Mm. Thus, being fruitful and multiplying is a part of God's noble plan for people.
And humans seem to have been done a very good job at that. They have failed at some other things, but not about
not about procreating.
If you look at Song of Solomon, one of the things in that's mentioned there is the whole idea of friendship that is to be shared with husband and wife, that their sexuality should be expressed within the context of a friendship. I think that's pretty significant. You know, this is not a subservient person over faced with a dominant person. This is two people who are enjoying all the features of life together, including their sexuality. Another one is, and the lesson makes quite a deal about this, is the whole idea of invitation, that another person is invited into the proverbial and experiential joys of sexual activity, which I think is another interesting feature here.
There's no dominance in that sense. There's no forced. No. It's a willing invitation and an acceptance into that invitation.
Yeah. And actually, maybe we should point out that biblically speaking, sexuality has two functions, two primary functions. One is procreation, and it seems to me that in the biblical days that was a primary focus. You know, even to this day, on some cultures, having a child, especially a son, is the primary goal in life, and obviously sexual activity is what produces that. But the other one, which I think is primary in our culture, because having children is very much a secondary thing these days, but the other one is to create a bond between two people. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, you guys have any comments about either one of those?
I think that we still struggle in our culture with the idea that the bond is created in a sexual encounter.
Oh yeah, because we want people to have sex without
right.
a bond.
Right. There shouldn't be any restriction on it. But there's more and more neurobiology that's coming out about the effect that sex and sexuality have on our brain and on our genetic code and on what we pass on to our children. All of those sorts of things. And I think it is really wonderful that we are thinking as Christians specifically about sex and how it bonds us to another human being, because otherwise, it is more of just of an urge, and it doesn't have any significance that way. And I think, kind of in our culture, we encounter a lot of sex that is degraded and demoralized almost, and it's just happenstance and no big thing.
And Jen, you work with young people. How significant is this for 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old kids who are just hitting puberty, right? And how important is communicating then the bond that relationships, like sexual relationships, communicate.
And just to jump in behind that, it is true, isn't it, that sexual activity produces the bond even if you are not thinking it will.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that talking to kids about that is not something we're very good at. We talk about the physical activity, or we talk about the need for abstinence, or we talk about the need to wait, but we don't talk about what healthy sexuality is, what healthy boundaries are, what healthy thought processes are, all of that.
And
we don't talk about that. And I think it damages our children's sexuality.
And why being respectful of your own sexuality is such a healthy thing.
Right. Yeah.
So what happens when people are promiscuous? What happens to the bonding capacity of sex?
Well, I think you bond to multiple people, but then you diminish the ability to continue to bond deeply.
Yeah, it diminishes the effectiveness of it. It's kind of like sticking a piece of sticky tape on the wall and then pulling off and sticking it back on. Eventually, it doesn't stick anymore.
And it also seems to me that in a sense, and I don't know how far to go with this, as maybe it's just kind of coming to my mind right now, but when you have sexual activity with multiple partners, I wonder how much you then are comparing, later partners that to earlier experiences, and then a sense of maybe lack of contentment can arise as well. So,
well, and I think I'm hesitant, Dave, to ascribe myself to your illustration of the sticky tape, because I think it denotes that there is a devaluation, even if there are multiple partners or multiple instances, and I disagree with that. I think that you can bond with someone, and it may not be intentional, but that bond still happens. And so you're creating different pathways within your brain and the way that you think. So I think it will rearrange your brain patterns and your thought patterns, but I don't think it devalues the impact of a situation.
I might grant you that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've heard it as a woman growing up. I heard, you know, the if you have sex before you're married, you're like a piece of gum. You've been chewed. Nobody wants you then, right? And it feels like, right, it's really disgusting and really diminishing. And I think we need to be careful how we speak about sexuality so that we're not diminishing it. Because I don't think that the encounters are diminished, but I think our awareness around them may be. And I think for me, there's a differentiation that needs to be stated there.
And it's also important what you noted, Jen, that when we think about multiple partners, we then create pathways that make later depth of relationship and maybe the depth of bonding within the sexual encounter, we really diminish its ability to grow deeper. Mm-hmm. So,
wow. So, you know, what do we do to preserve a sense of what I would say near sacredness about sexuality in a culture that sees it as another way of saying hello on a sunny afternoon?
How do we celebrate it with? Well, I read Song of Solomon, and the word sex, as far as I know, never shows up.
Never does.
The language is in poetry, which means it's beautiful. Its meaning is at multiple layers, and it's a long book. It's not two verses.
And it is triggering imagination.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Intentionally, I think.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And so in that sense, I think that there is room to have conversations about it, maybe even in playful ways, and that are beautiful, that are noble, without shying away from the topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that thinking of it in the context of something beyond just a satisfaction and reaching a goal is really important, that we keep that in context as people who are following Christ and are empowered to explore, knowing that it's within the godly parameter and within His desire for us as well.
And so really, sexuality is something that should be regarded, I don't really want to call it sacred, but that there is an element of spirit, if I can put it that way, attached to sexuality, that is quite capable of creating powerful bonds between a husband and a wife, and that, you know, by the design of God, that's one of the things that keeps the what shall I say, the wheels rolling, you know, because everybody who's been married knows that there are ups and downs, but that kind of bond can help sustain people along the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Any quick closing comments as we end here?
Yeah, I'll just say one really quick, Dave, and that is when I was a teenager, our Pathfinder leaders communicated with us the beauty of sexuality as God's wedding present to a husband and wife, and that it was worth opening and it was worth waiting to open, but that it was a beautiful thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I appreciated growing up with it being something worth waiting for because of its beauty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ah, well, thank you. Yeah, I guess that when you're afraid to talk about this or you kind of make it sketchy, then it disappears into murkiness and then people don't know what to do with it. So we should recognize it as a God-given capacity that is intended to benefit people, produce offspring, and create a bond between husbands and wives. And so their sexuality is a gift that they give to each other for those purposes. So,
Hey,
thank you very much. Very interesting. We'll be moving on to our next lesson here momentarily, but thank you for listening, and I want to thank my conversation partners and our engineer Brad Williams for the good word. I'm Dave Thomas.